So, what if I told you that the most sophisticated framework for processing severe childhood trauma, or, defining absolute morality, actually involved a kid named Boris wearing a plastic bucket on his head and falling into a muddy creek?
I mean, it sounds completely absurd when you put it like that, but when you look at the underlying mechanics of what is actually happening in that creek, you start to realize that childhood play is just, well, it's a lot more than just killing a summer afternoon.
Right, and that is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to today's deep
Yeah.
dive. We are exploring this genuinely fascinating set of narrative logs that chronicle a highly intricate live-action role-play adventure, or a LRP, created entirely by a group of kids.
Yeah, and the mission for our deep dive today is really to look past the foam swords and the imaginary dragons. We want to uncover the intense psychological architecture underneath it all.
Exactly. Because the level of commitment and world-building in these sources is going to make you fundamentally rethink how we use storytelling to navigate the very real challenges in our adult lives.
It really will. But to understand the psychology, we first need to know who we are analyzing here. The logs give us this core adventuring party, right? Operating through their chosen avatars.
Right, we have a whole cast of characters.
Yeah, so first we have Agatha, who embodies the brave, honorable knight Redmayne. Then there's Tom, playing the rugged Lord Explorer
And
Thomas.
Sabrina, who, I love this, she spends most of her time fully committed to being a shape-shifting cat named Bragwaine.
Yes, and behind all of this is Maximilian, playing a mysterious and immensely powerful sorcerer named Pelles.
So I want to start by looking at the physical environment they've constructed, because they don't just sit in a circle and say, hey, let's pretend we are in a castle. They actually build the castle.
They really do. The physical labor is intense.
Right. So the logs start at this massive ancient oak they call the Gnarly Tree. And Tom is up in the branches, painstakingly building a hidden fort. He isn't just, throwing some sticks together.
No, not at all.
He is up there hammering modular plywood sections that he literally pre-built at home. He's bolting them to the frame of the tree. He has even engineered and installed a fully functional rope elevator.
Which is wild for a kid. The sheer amount of physical labor described in these logs is just a crucial detail to keep in mind.
Yeah, and it's everywhere in the source material. Across town, you've got Agatha sitting in her bedroom, pricking her thumb for the fifth time with a sewing needle because she insists on hand-making a green and gold satin banner before she even straps on her foam sword.
Right, she bleeds for the aesthetic.
Literally. And the way they blend this tactile reality with their fantasy is just seamless. Like, there's this terrifying moment where Sabrina is sneaking up on Tom in the tree and she actually slips.
Oh, yeah, that part was incredibly tense.
I mean, Tom drops his hammer and uses genuine real-world martial arts agility to catch her midair. He locks his legs around a branch, and they both just crash into a bush.
It was a very real physical near miss. Like, that could have easily ended in a trip to the hospital.
Absolutely. But the second Sabrina realizes she is physically safe, she doesn't cry or, break character. She shifts instantly back into her cat persona, Bragwaine, shakes her jingling pendant, and warns Tom that she bites.
Which is just incredible commitment. It operates almost like a fully immersive augmented reality, but the technology powering it is just their absolute total commitment to the bit.
Right, but I'm looking at this and wondering, why do they go through the actual physical pain and effort? I mean, if the whole point is imagination, why not just imagine a working elevator? Why bleed over a sewing needle?
That's a great question. You'd think the physical limitations of plywood would hold the imagination back, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it actually does the exact opposite. In psychology, there is a concept often referred to as the IKEA effect. It's this cognitive bias where we place a disproportionately high value on things we partially create ourselves.
Oh, like when you build a bookshelf and suddenly you love it more than a nicer one you just bought.
Exactly. By injecting real-world sweat equity into the game, they are providing tangible anchors for their imagination. When you spend hours hitting your thumb with a hammer or bleeding onto a satin banner, the world you are building demands a profound level of respect.
So it elevates the activity from a flimsy game of pretend into a highly structured alternate reality.
Precisely. You aren't just telling your friends, "Hey, I have a fortress." You are presenting a fortress that you literally bled for. It forces the other players to respect the space.
That makes a lot of sense. So the physical object serves as proof that the fantasy is real.
Right, it creates a shared grounded reality. If the elevator is physically real, then the imaginary stakes surrounding that elevator become psychologically real.
Man, That distinction makes the actual adventuring logs so much more compelling. So let's look at Knight Redmayne's quest. She is being guided by Bragwaine the Cat through these deeply wooded areas that they've mapped out.
Yeah, with those intense names, right? Like the Point of Peril and the Bridge of Sorrows.
Yes. And the logs describe Redmayne dodging imaginary gouts of liquid flame, physically rolling in the dirt to avoid the heat, and slaying a magical dragon. But then, and this is where it gets weird, she encounters an entity called the Changeling, which is actually Tom in a disguise.
Right, the Lord Explorer moonlighting as a monster.
Exactly. And the Changeling stops the epic battle to give Redmayne a literal pop quiz on wilderness survival.
This is quite the tonal shift, to say the least.
I have to stop here because this makes zero sense to me. I mean, I play video games and read fantasy to escape the real world. If I am in the middle of fighting a dragon and the game pauses to make me do math or take a geography test, I am immediately checking out.
Yeah, nobody wants homework in the middle of a boss fight.
Right. So why interrupt a high-stakes fantasy quest with a Boy Scout manual?
Well, because you are looking at it purely as escapism. And for these kids, it isn't escapism at all. It is a framework for mastery. Look at the specific questions the Changeling asks her.
Okay, yeah. He tests her on how to find north in a forest. She answers that moss grows on the north side of trees, but he pushes her further, making her explain that narrow tree rings also point north.
Which is pretty advanced for a kid.
Totally. Then he tests her on using a pocket watch to track south by pointing the shorthand at the sun. He asks her which way to travel if she sees birds flying near a mountain peak.
And she has to know the answer is opposite to the birds because birds won't fly over a peak.
Right. He even makes her recite meteorological folklore, like, red in the morning, sailors take warning.
See, every single one of those questions requires legitimate, practical intelligence. By embedding real-world survival trivia into a magical trial, the game is actively rewarding preparation and knowledge.
So it's like sneaking vegetables into a kid's meal.
Essentially, yes. This touches on a concept in education called narrative-driven learning. Human brains are notoriously bad at retaining raw data, but we are exceptional at remembering stories.
Okay, so when you tie dry facts, like how tree rings grow, to a highly emotional narrative about surviving a magical forest, the knowledge actually sticks.
Exactly. In fact, the Changeling actually tells her in the log that not all in life is a battle to be conquered. It's an experience where even in failure, you find knowledge.
Wow. So they are using the structure of the fantasy to master the reality around them. It is an incredibly sophisticated learning mechanism masquerading as play.
It really is.
That honestly reframes the whole concept of a LRP for me. But as we move deeper into the source material, the logs pivot. We stop looking at the mechanics of the game and start looking at the psychology of the kids pulling the strings.
Right, the behind-the-scenes drama.
Exactly. This happens right after Redmayne defeats the Green Knight.
Mm.
And for context, the Green Knight is just a neighborhood kid named Boris who was given a bucket helm and a green tabard.
Poor Boris.
Yeah, Redmayne unceremoniously trips him into a muddy creek to win the battle. But after this, they break character. They sit down by the river for a picnic with sandwiches and lemonade. And this is where we finally get a clear look at Maximilian.
Ah, yes. The architect of the entire world.
Yes, the boy behind the curtain. In the game, Maximilian is Pelles. He's this prestigious sorcerer, functioning almost like the Fisher King of their mythology.
Right, he literally hands out treasure.
Exactly. He awards Redmayne with mithril chainmail gauntlets to honor her bravery. He is benevolent and powerful. But at the picnic, the illusion drops completely.
And the contrast between the avatar and the real boy is just jarring.
It's incredibly dark, honestly. Mm-hmm. We learn that Max relies on a walking stick in real life. He is highly introverted and dour. During the picnic, Agatha politely offers to let him ride a horse she happens to be watching, and the mood instantly freezes.
Yeah, that moment is so tense.
Max quietly declines and mutters, "Father would kill me if the horse didn't." So we find out he is deeply traumatized by some past incident with a horse.
And we also learn his parents are wealthy, strict, and largely absent.
Right. Max effectively funded this entire fantasy operation himself. He used his own allowance to bribe Boris to put a bucket on his head and fall into a creek, just so his friends would have a villain to fight.
It's heartbreaking, really. When you analyze Max's real-life situation, you see a textbook example of someone with a very low external locus of control.
Meaning he feels like he has no power over his own life.
Exactly. He is physically vulnerable. He carries significant unaddressed trauma. He lives under the crushing pressure of a demanding father who isn't even around. In his day-to-day life, Max has almost no say in what happens to him.
I keep picturing him like a reclusive, brilliant film director. You know, he uses his loud, charismatic little sister, Sabrina, as his leading actor and producer, sending her out to interact with the world so he doesn't have to.
That analogy works perfectly, but look at what the avatar of Pelis provides for him. Through Pelis, Max exercises total, unquestioned authority.
Because he dictates the rules of engagement.
Right. He is the generous benefactor, handing out Mithril. Psychology often looks at how avatars in roleplay are used in forms of exposure therapy. By creating a world where he is essentially a god, Max creates a safe psychological sandbox.
So it allows him to interact with the world that has otherwise caused him immense pain, but entirely on his own terms.
Precisely.
That makes me wonder how often we do this as adults. Like, do we all adopt these kinds of professional or social avatars to mask our real-world vulnerabilities?
Oh, every single day? Think about you, the listener, going into a high-stakes meeting or a difficult social situation. We all put on our own version of the Mithril armor.
That's so true. We adopt a specific tone of voice, or we wear clothes that project a certain authority.
We lean into a professional title. Max's mask just happens to be a legendary sorcerer.
Well, what fascinates me is that the sandbox doesn't stay static. As the kids process these vulnerabilities, the game evolves right along with them. The narrative in the logs physically moves away from the wild woods and takes us into the home of Max and Sabrina's aunt and uncle, the Winters' residence.
Right, a totally different environment.
The setting is described so vividly. It's this dusty, museum-like Victorian home. It is packed with breakable knickknacks and watched over by solemn-faced family portraits.
It feels incredibly restrictive.
Yes, like the ultimate symbol of rigid adult rules. The kids gather in the kitchen to eat hand-cranked vanilla bean ice cream. And it's in this domestic, highly controlled setting that Max announces a massive pivot for the game.
He introduces the quest for the Holy Grail.
Using goblets they borrowed from a church play, no less. But here's the major shift. Max declares that this new quest will not involve physical combat.
No foam swords, no dragons.
No tripping kids into creeks. The kids sit around the kitchen table, actively brainstorming what they call spiritual tests. Agatha starts rattling off actual historical codes of chivalry, protecting the innocent, exhibiting self-control, defending the weak, showing mercy.
They are completely abandoning the physical realm to navigate the philosophical one.
Right. They start designing scenarios to test these codes. For example, having someone play a beggar who intentionally drops money just to see if the knight is honest enough to return it.
Or setting up a scenario where a knight is tempted to attack an undesirable opponent without verifying if they are actually an enemy.
Now, I'm struggling to see why children would voluntarily give up the fun of hitting each other with swords to take a morality test. That just sounds like they're assigning themselves homework.
It does sound like that, yeah. But to understand why they do this, you have to look at how cognitive development mirrors the evolution of play. Early childhood play is almost entirely about testing physical boundaries.
Like, how fast can I run? Can I climb this tree?
Exactly. Can I defeat this imaginary monster? But as these kids grow and their social awareness expands, physical mastery just isn't enough anymore. They need to test ethical boundaries.
So they are trying to figure out what it actually means to be a good person rather than just a strong person.
Exactly. They are running moral simulations. Think about how vital this is. In the real world, ethical dilemmas usually come with massive, life-altering consequences.
Right. If you make the wrong moral choice at work or in a relationship, the fallout is very real.
Yeah, but these kids have intuitively built a low-stakes simulator to test their ethical reflexes before the real world forces them to make a hard choice. By having a fake beggar drop fake money, they get to experience the internal friction of temptation and honesty without ruining their lives.
That is brilliant. And that brings us to the absolute climax of the source material. To run a proper moral simulation, they need a new test subject. Max declares they need a knight who is pure of heart for this grail quest.
So they go recruiting.
Yeah, Agatha goes out scouting and tracks down a boy named Simon. The scene takes place at Foxworthy's sweet shop. The vibe is pure Americana checkerboard tiles, a chrome soda bar, spinning stools.
It's very picturesque.
It is.
Yeah.
And Simon is sitting alone in a booth, drinking an ice cream malt and doodling lyrics in a notepad.
Now, it's important to note that Simon has a very fixed, very negative narrative about who he is.
Completely fixed. When Agatha approaches the booth and floats the idea of him joining the game as a hero, Simon shoots it down immediately. He actively self-identifies as a coward.
He literally calls himself a jester.
Yes, a jester whose only goal in life is staying out of his uncle's way. He tells Agatha, quote, Show me a monster, and I'll show you the soles of my feet. He has entirely written himself off.
Which is a tragic but very common defense mechanism.
But Agatha refuses to accept his self-assessment. She offers him the role anyway, and the execution of this next moment is just cinematic perfection.
Oh, I love this part.
Right as Simon is hesitating, Sabrina arrives on the sidewalk outside the sweet shop window. She's wearing a white gown and these tiny, puffy, vestigial angel wings.
Because of course she is.
Naturally. She walks right through the front door, introduces herself to the proprietor of the shop as an angelic messenger, and walks straight over to Simon's booth. She presents him with the borrowed church goblet, their holy grail. She looks him in the eye and says that heaven speeds him on his way.
The visual of that happening in the middle of a mundane soda shop is just incredible.
And Simon's reaction is instant. He slides out of the booth, drops to his knees on the checkerboard floor in front of everyone, and fully adopts the formal, brave persona of Sir Lefolon.
Just completely flips a switch.
He swears a vow that neither food nor drink shall pass his lips until he is ready for the quest, and he literally stands up and throws his half-finished ice cream malt into the trash.
The ultimate sacrifice for a kid in a sweet shop.
Seriously. Now, it's a great story beat, but realistically, I have a hard time believing this. Can handing someone a borrowed cup actually override years of ingrained cowardice? Does a fake title rewire your brain in 3 seconds?
Well, it doesn't rewire your brain, no. It bypasses the faulty wiring you've installed yourself. What you are seeing with Simon is a textbook example of cognitive reframing mixed with what psychologists call the protagonist effect.
Okay, unpack that for me.
So Simon had typecast himself based on his family dynamics. He mentions needing to stay out of his uncle's way, which implies a home life where being invisible is the safest strategy.
Right.
He decided his role was to be the fool, the jester, because jesters aren't seen as threats.
Ah, so his cowardice wasn't a personality trait at all. It was a survival strategy.
Yes. But when Agatha and Sabrina walked into that shop, they didn't try to argue with his logic. They didn't tell him he wasn't a coward. They simply handed him a new script.
They treated him with the reverence of a noble knight.
Exactly. The courage was already latent inside of him. The title just gave him the psychological permission to access it without feeling like he was breaking his own safety rules. Sometimes all it takes for a person to step up in their real life is for someone else to cast them in a better role.
Wow. They saw him as a knight, so he had no choice but to become one. You know, we have covered an immense amount of psychological ground today. When we opened these logs, we were looking at a stack of plywood, some hand-sewn banners, and a kid falling out of a tree.
Just basic neighborhood games.
Right. But what we actually found was an incredibly sophisticated mechanism. These kids built an alternate reality where they could master the natural world, safely confront and manage their deepest traumas, define their personal moral codes, and literally rewrite their own identities from the ground up.
And the core takeaway for you listening today is to recognize that these mechanics do not disappear when we reach adulthood.
We just get better at hiding them.
Exactly. We might outgrow the hidden tree houses. We might stop carrying foam swords. But the psychological architecture of role play remains completely intact. How we choose to dress in the morning, the professional titles we fight for, the narratives we subconsciously believe about our own potential that never stops.
So we are all still LARPing every single day, just with much higher stakes and much more expensive costumes.
We absolutely are.
That is wild. So let's go back to the blueprints of your own life for a second. You are the architect of your own reality. Think about the character you've been playing recently. Are you the jester, hiding in the corner, just trying to stay out of the way?
Or are you the mastermind, pulling strings from the shadows to protect yourself?
Or are you the knight, stepping up to the challenge? And to build on that, think about the digital avatars you use every single day. Your social media profiles, your bios, the curated photos. We are constantly updating our digital character sheets, often without even realizing it.
And eventually, the mask becomes the face.
Exactly. So look at your life right now. Look at the digital and physical masks you're wearing. If you don't like the role you're currently playing, what's stopping you from writing yourself a new script today?